Thanks, folks. My name is Pat Fetty. I'm co-presenting this afternoon with Alan Stewart. We are part of what we call internally the partner and customer ecosystem team. So essentially, our team drives all of our partner engagements and all of our customer engagements, including running things like our technology adoption program. So has anybody participated in a TAP with Microsoft before? Cool. Okay. So we can breeze through a lot of that that part of the presentation. So what we want to talk to you about today is we're going to talk about some of the, specifically, the private cloud features and scenarios that we were validating with real external customers as part of this effort. And as the title says, we are definitely going to talk about some of the lessons learned. That's really kind of what you folks want to hear about. You don't want to hear, hey, everything went great and the software is perfect. We're going to talk to you about things that our real-world customers actually ran into, and then we're actually going to talk about how we address those. So there's no point in finding problems if you don't fix them, of course. So we're going to kind of walk you through that, and we're also going to walk you through kind of where we are in the program, some of the next steps, and we're going to talk about some specific scenarios around storage and networking that our customers and some of the challenges that they're facing, because as you know from your participation this week, Server 2012 has a whole lot of new capabilities, scenarios, and features that we try to get them all validated as part of this effort. So we're specifically, we're going to talk, like I said, we're going to talk about cloud technologies here. We're going to talk about something that we called internally our customer zero work. Have any of you ever visited Redmond before? Wow, that's really cool. On campus, we have a department or a building, if you will, called the Enterprise Engineering Center, which is a massive laboratory where customers can come in, validate our solutions, not just server solutions, but anything from Exchange to Link to the desktop. And so we utilized those resources, all that hardware and network and capabilities, to build out a lot of these scenarios, these cloud-based scenarios, before we even gave any customer software. In fact, before we'd even released a beta. So we'll talk a little bit about that work because it's something we'd never done before and it's a bit unprecedented. I'm then going to talk to you about something called Project OnRamp, which focuses on hybrid cloud scenarios. So internally, when we think about these things and we discuss cloud, which is a buzzword you've heard a million times this week, we don't really delineate between private cloud, public cloud, and hybrid cloud when we talk about the software, because we've essentially built an operating system and have software that can build any type of cloud. But the hybrid scenario is one that's unique, and by definition, the hybrid cloud is where you have some resources on-site and some resources either at another data center that you own, or in our case, and what we validated, at a public hosting provider, like Azure, for example. And then we're going to talk more specifically about technologies around storage, networking, and some of the other generic lessons that we learned. So just to give you a bit of background, most of you, about more than half of the room, raised their hand, and you understand what a technology adoption program is. I'm just going to call it TAP from here on out because that's the easy acronym. These are run by the engineering team. We are an extension of the engineering team. And essentially, the idea is to validate software before we ship it. And if you know anything about the history of Windows, I've been at Microsoft 15 years, and basically my entire career has been in Windows, is that we would sit around, build software, get some customer input, think of some great ideas, and then at beta we would kind of toss it over the wall to you and say, hey, what do you think? We've gotten a lot more intelligent. That's not me. We've gotten a lot more intelligent now about how we do that, where we have actually involved customers in part as a part of the planning, and more importantly, the pre-planning process, so that the customer voice and opinion goes into the operating system before we've even written a single specification. So again, what we've done in Server 2012 is really unprecedented in that we used to be, a campus full of geeks that would think up features and scenarios without really understanding what the customer requirements are. This time around, the customer is involved at day zero, actually. So currently in the program, folks that are validating the cloud scenarios for us, there's about 50 of them. They are all running either the beta or the RC in production. If you know, we just released the release candidate for Server 2012 a couple of weeks ago, and so customers are migrating from beta to RC. We're right smack in the middle of that. And then, of course, we've been validating these scenarios end-to-end, but when you talk about cloud and virtual machines and virtualization, the key partner to it for us is System Center Virtual Machine Manager. So as we sit here today, I know it's confusing for folks, but they have just released System Center 2012. We have a server called 2012, but the two products are incompatible. So System Center 2012 Service Pack 1 will be the release that works with Server 2012, and they've just put out recently a customer technical preview of that. So the schedules aren't quite 100% aligned, so we had to do a lot of this validation essentially without SCVMM. We didn't have a working build of VMM, so we had to do a lot of things manually using PowerShell and some of the other tools like VMM creation and deployment. But now that we have working software that from System Center that works with Server 2012, we're going to kind of step in and look at those scenarios as well. So the scenarios in general, just to give you some definitions, I touched on this briefly. The definition of hybrid cloud, we talked about that. The private cloud is essentially an on-premise solution. In your data center, you have the lock and key, you own the servers, everything is within your confines. And then, you know, of course, like as I mentioned, since we didn't have System Center, which is a great management tool that allows you to automate a lot of these tasks, we used a lot of PowerShell to do this. I'm sure if you've sat in sessions this week, you've heard the investment that we made in PowerShell, and Satya touched on it in his keynote, you know, somewhere upwards of 2,400 new commandlets. So we've actually have a very rock-solid, robust inbox management solution with PowerShell. And then in the hybrid scenario, you know, there's some key challenges that I'll touch on in a minute, but essentially virtual machine isolation, multi-tenancy, security, things like that. Again, System Center really helps alleviate a lot of those, but when we had to validate these with customers, these are some of the challenges that we ran into. And then, of course, as we stand here today, we're getting into the System Center integration piece. So some of the things that we really focused on, and some of these features you may or may not be familiar with, but when we talk about building a cloud, these are things that are actually very, very critical. NIC teaming is by far the most popular feature in the cloud space, and the reason is that today it's extremely painful to do. It requires a third-party solution, and that third-party solution is usually provided by the NIC vendor, and of course that solution only works with their NICs. So if you have Broadcom NICs, you have to use a Broadcom solution. If you have Intel NICs, you have to use their solution. What we've done is we've extracted that away from the hardware, and so now we have a NIC teaming solution in the box that works with any card. So we've really made that so much simpler to deploy, and essentially everybody who's building a cloud solution is doing NIC teaming just because it makes perfect sense to do so. Bandwidth control, another very important thing in either the hybrid or the private cloud space, and we utilize quality of service, or QoS, in that scenario. And so we've made a lot of enhancements around simpler policy creation to allow you to do bandwidth control. If you're running on a 10-gigabyte infrastructure, QoS control is almost mandatory or essential to ensure that, you know, various services and activities that you're doing aren't eating up all the bandwidth on that 10-gig pipe. So you use technologies like QoS to say, okay, for live migration, I'm going to dedicate this amount of bandwidth, and for replica, I'm going to dedicate this amount of bandwidth, et cetera. Data center bridging is also an industry standard solution. It has never been inboxed for our server product before, but again, it's another option to do bandwidth control between the server and your switch. SRILV, or single root input output virtualization, is a really slick feature. It does require an SRILV capable NIC, and it also requires your server support this in the BIOS. And essentially what this gives you is that your virtual machines can now bypass the hypervisor completely and talk directly to the NIC hardware. So the result of that is you get much better processor performance, or less utilization and less memory utilization as well, and you also get performance on the wire as well. SRILV NICs are super cheap. I picked one up for about $125. I've got them in my servers in the lab, and the difference that you see, which we'll be documenting at RTM, is really phenomenal for $125. Hyper-V over SMB2, if you've sat in sessions around storage this week, you've probably been aware that we've made huge investments in SMB, and Alan's going to go in a lot more detail around that. But when we talk to customers, and again, customer input was the root of this operating system release, their biggest cost is storage. How many of you are running some kind of cloud solution on-prem today? Almost everybody in the room. Would you concur that storage is your most expensive aspect? A lot of head nodding. Perfect. So at least we're on the right path and we're talking the same language. And then storage migration. Again, something new that allows you to do storage migration as well as, well, you could always do virtual machine live migration, but now you can do them distinctly differently. So you can keep your VHDs in a separate location than your virtual machines. And so from a maintenance perspective, this is actually a really important thing for customers. So when we talked, I mentioned the sort of the pre-beta work that we did. And we call, again, our term was customer zero because you guys are customer one. So for us, it's customer zero. The idea behind this, again, was to make sure that we understood how these scenarios worked before we just gave software to you and a 100-page document and say, try and build this and good luck and tell us how it goes. So we got a lot of really good feedback, and more importantly, we actually found a lot of issues and lessons learned before you guys ever even knew we were doing an operating system. So this work is something we will absolutely continue to do moving forward, and we're utilizing our own internal resources. As it turns out, the EEC is sort of the third leg of our division, so getting access to that hardware is very easy for us. And keep in mind, just remember that name, Enterprise Engineering Center, or EEC, because it's probably one of the best kept secrets at Microsoft is that this is a free resource for any customer to use. So in other words, you could go back home, talk to your account manager and say, hey, this guy Pat was telling me about this EEC thing. Can you find out more? Essentially, all you have to do is, you know, pay your way out to Redmond, you know, your hotel and per diem and all that. But essentially, if you're looking at an exchange deployment or you're looking at some kind of cloud deployment or you want to evaluate Server 2012 in certain scenarios, the EEC is 100% free. You get a dedicated expert program manager. You have access to all this hardware, and more importantly, the EEC actually builds out your network before you even arrive. So part of the process is that you submit some documents, give us information about how your environment is set up, and then by the time you land in Redmond and walk into Building 25, your environment is there and already set up. It's a phenomenal resource, and I highly recommend people use it. So again, we started this last summer. At that point, we were just sort of in the thinking phase, you know, at the very beginning of specifications. But we did have working software, so we were able to build these things out. And the two links that you see here are samples and examples that actually came out of this work. So right after us today, Yigal is doing a talk on building cloud solutions on using PowerShell. So the samples that came out of our customer zero work are actually out on TechNet right now. So if you wanted to build your own cloud solution and wanted a script sample, it's out there and you can download it tonight. I know it's a bit of an eye chart, but when we focused on these scenarios, on the cloud scenarios that we wanted to build, we essentially looked at three different types of clouds. And so the different types are what we call dynamic, high performance, and best ROI. Dynamic is a cloud that really has a lot of moving parts, where you're constantly moving virtual machines and moving storage around, or you're constantly onboarding new customers, and so you're spinning up virtual machines on a very frequent basis. So on the left-hand side here, you know, this is the kind of scenario with some of the features referenced here, and of course you'll have these slides so you can review them later on, that allows you to do that. And so when we built these out, we actually learned a lot of things about the hardware and about what the software was capable of. In the middle, we have the high-performance cloud, which is, you know, based on a 10-gig e-infrastructure, based on SMB-based storage. And then, of course, the high ROI, again, is also based on SMB storage and utilizes a technology called remote dynamic memory access, which, again, essentially allows you to utilize memory on the file server storage end, which gives you an incredible performance boost. I think Alan has a slide in here maybe later, but you know, we were demoing this a few weeks ago at another show, and the storage guys were actually doing SMB-based storage with RDMA, and we're pushing about 6 gig a second. So you're basically pushing the entire contents of a DVD per second, all based on SMB-based storage. So it's pretty amazing stuff. So the hybrid cloud. If you listened to the keynote on Monday, or if you've ever heard Satya talk before, the hybrid cloud for Microsoft is probably the most important scenario. And the reason why that is that private clouds are there today. You guys have them, most of those of you folks that raise your hand. The tools have been there. They've been there for a couple of releases. You can, you can use Hyper-V. You can spin up VMs. It's all good stuff. But the hybrid scenario is now where you start to see the benefits of the cloud. And now you start to ask yourself, well, why can't I just have somebody else host these services for me? So one of the big announcements we had this week was Azure getting into the infrastructure as a service business, which is a phenomenal news because now you can start thinking about taking all the physical hardware that you own on site that's running your Exchange workloads or Link or SQL or line of business apps or whatever and start to push them to a public cloud. However, we realize that nobody is just going to flip a switch and push everything up into another hoster's data center. So it's that hybrid scenario where you have stuff on site and stuff that's being hosted by a public provider. And that hybrid scenario is going to be around for a very long time until sort of the cloud solutions and public providers can prove that they can actually run your entire business. And at that point, you may push everything up to a public provider. So we really, really wanted to focus on this particular scenario in terms of validation because it's a lot more difficult. Right? So now when you talk about having your SQL workload, moving it from on-site to the cloud, you ask questions like, how do I access it? And how do I know it's secure? And if I'm pushing this up to a provider, does it live on a server I own? Or is this a multi-tenant thing? So all these questions come up, and these are questions that we have to answer. And so when we do this, some of the goals we wanted to get out of this really are to come back with some best practices, not just if you were to use Azure as the public cloud provider, but any number of hosting providers out there. In fact, do we have any hosting providers in the room? Anybody work for a hosting provider? No one? Not a single hoster. All right. Well, these folks are excited about this because obviously they see this as new business opportunities, and you should be excited about it as well because now you can look at really true cost savings by pushing workloads up into a public cloud provider. So when we came up with this project, we wanted to have a sort of a variety of customers. In the program, you saw on a few slides ago, we have about 15 hosting providers that are actually literally spread around the world that we're partnering with to do this. And so to validate this properly, we took customers that were in the tap, that are enterprises, small, medium business, VARs, VAPs, whatever, and we kind of partnered them up with the hosters in the program. Because at that point, everybody's covered under the NDA umbrella. They get 24/7 support from Microsoft. And so when we did this partnering, we looked at, okay, well, what... Great. Now we have a hybrid cloud, but what are the workloads and scenarios that we want to validate? So the first one we wanted to tackle is Hyper-V replication. You guys know about HVR? You guys sit in the sessions yesterday? This is a solution that customers are extremely excited about. For those of you that don't know, Hyper-V replica is essentially an inbox disaster recovery solution that we've created for Server 2012 and Hyper-V. So when you think about this from the sort of the customer and the business perspective, hosting providers look at something like replica as a new stream of revenue, as a new business opportunity. Because if you're a small medium business, or let's say you've got a 10 to 50 servers on premise, you probably have a backup solution today. It's probably SAN-based and it's probably expensive and difficult to maintain. But now you can start looking at taking those virtual machines and replicating them to a hosting provider who will guarantee you security, and then from there they can even back up your VMs as well. So this replica cross-site scenario is actually extremely important. So customers are seeing the benefit of basically ditching their current backup solution, which is SAN replication based, again, which is expensive, and just being able to cut somebody a check every month and say, okay, I'm just going to replicate my virtual machines to you, and from there you'll back them up and you'll guarantee me secure access, et cetera. And then, of course, to do this, we utilize a variety of technologies like load balance failover, which is NIC teaming, PowerShell to vSwitch, et cetera. So when we looked at this, we asked a lot of the questions that customers are asking or asked today is, so how do we do this in the hybrid cloud experience? The bridging between an enterprise and a hosting provider, there are lots of things to think about, right? You're talking about connecting network to network. And so guaranteeing isolation, guaranteeing uptime, SLAs that basically allow you to ensure your data is safe when you push it over there. Because keep in mind, replica is replicating a virtual machine. That virtual machine is running a workload. It has very important data on it, right? It's something that's key to your business. So you want to be very careful and ask a lot of questions around, okay, well, after I replicate it, what is happening with that virtual machine? In the enterprise, it's about, replica works in a couple different ways. If you have multiple data centers, you can replicate your VMs in between data centers. So you may have a primary and a backup. In this hybrid scenario we're talking about, the enterprise would then be, replicating to Azure or to any other, public hosting provider. So it's basically you're going from a trusted zone to an untrusted zone. And then the use cases really are truly around disaster recovery. There are cases as well around something we call a planned failover. So since we're in Florida, right, and this is Hurricane City, you can say, okay, we know a hurricane's coming, so we need to shut down this office here. And fortunately, we have all of our virtual machines replicated to our hosting provider so that we can shut things down here, bring up those virtual machines at the hosting provider, make the required DNS changes so that the VMs themselves can be found, and now you have your business running in a public hosting provider with zero interruption. So these are the scenarios and the use cases that we looked at when we were going to demonstrate this or to validate this. So in a second here, I'm going to show you a demo. Am I? Cool. All right. We're having the demo guys were frowning on us a minute ago. So as I mentioned, we had 15 hosting providers. The one that I'm going to demonstrate Replica with for you is a company called GCI, Global Communications Institution. They're a major telco in the UK. And essentially, this is how they have Hyper-V Replica set up on their site. I'm coming in today from the public internet, from the connection here in Orlando. I'm going to create a VPN connection to their clustered servers on the other end. I'm actually going to connect to their RAS server. And then basically, I'm going to replicate across the internet, across my IPsec tunnel, to their servers on the other end. And the reason why I'm going to demonstrate this for you is I'm going to show you how brain dead simple this is. Because if a guy like me can do it, the rest of you can absolutely do it. So, getting back to some of the challenges we had with this. So I spent 2 days on site with GCI and a couple other hosters when we built this out. And the first thing we ran into is that the site-to-site connectivity piece. Microsoft has edge products like TMG, and we have our own VPN server. And then hosting providers, just like yourselves, you have all different solutions on the edge that you use for communication, whether it's a Cisco ASA or a Juniper firewall or whatever it may be. But figuring out how to get these two pieces to talk, even getting two Microsoft products to talk in some cases, were actually really challenging. It's something we were able to work through. But when you talk about different companies and getting their devices to work, we certainly ran into some challenges. And when you talk about replicating from me to a public hosting provider, you have to use a certificate as the credential to do that. Originally, we had some difficult requirements with regards to the certificate that we've actually eased and fixed here on out so that you can use a cert that you've created yourself using Make Cert or any other utility. You can use a cert that's issued by a Microsoft CA, or you can go buy a third-party certificate. And so a lot of the hosting providers today have like a wildcarded SSL cert or something that they use for their web providers, and now you can use that same credential for Replica. And the multi-tenancy piece, I apologize, I didn't do that. But the multi-tenancy piece is actually one of the bigger challenges. We've already talked about some of these issues, but from the hoster's perspective, as they create an SLA with you, guaranteeing that only you will be able to see your virtual machines. Hyper-V Replica is a host-to-host type of solution, so essentially once that VM gets to their side, they have to guarantee isolation. And so there's multiple ways to do that. Just so happens our partner today is using VLANs as a way to do that, which is probably what everybody in here does for isolation as well. But we have some new technologies coming out, specifically something called Hyper-V Network Virtualization that will also assist with these. So how are we addressing these? We will have documentation by RTM or a little bit after that will explain to you how to get TMG, RRAS, some of these other Microsoft-based solutions, how to properly set them up to communicate. What I will tell you what's out of scope is that we won't be able to do this for Cisco and Juniper and everybody else, but the site-to-site connectivity piece, once you have that figured out, that's really the hardest part of this whole thing, as I'll show you in the demo here in a sec. And then, of course, we will come up with best practices, both for the hosting side as well as the customer side. So based on the feedback that we got from customers that were participating in this, I'd mentioned we'd taken DCRs, or design change requests, several of them, to make the cert requirements much less. We now have documentation. We had it at beta, and it's being revved for RC about how you can do this on your own. In other words, if you had two untrusted sites or your site to an untrusted site, we have documentation that walks you through how to set it up on both ends. Very simple and straightforward. And then we took the DCR to allow SSL wildcarded certs as well. So some of the other challenges that we had is that this entire process, as we stand here today, is manual. So in other words, I have to go to the hosting provider, say I want to participate in the service, and then they send you VPN information and a certificate, and then you import the certificate. And so it's a whole manual process to get this up and running. When we RTM, essentially every hoster that we worked with said we need to have this automated. So how this will work when we RTM, and especially when System Center comes online, is that you as a customer will go to website, you know, whatever. You will say, I want to sign up for disaster recovery. You'll walk through, give some information, your credit card and all that, and they'll spit you out a machine certificate that basically with instructions on how to import it into your machine. And at that point, essentially, on the back end, they'll assign you a private VLAN that is only yours. And from there, you can actually start replicating. But that whole onboarding process today requires PowerShell and some other manual steps. But by the time we ship this solution, it'll actually be completely automated. And System Center, again, will help with that. Multi-tenancy, again, is a very, very difficult problem to solve. Our hosting partners are working with us closely to understand this. Again, the multi-tenancy solution today that's been around forever, that's tried and true, is VLANs. However, if you're familiar with VLANs, VLANs do not scale. And the difficulty with VLANs, when you talk about a process like onboarding customers, is that when you create a VLAN, it has to be spread out to all of your switches in the infrastructure so that they understand it. And that's a difficult thing to do. So when we talk about Hyper-V network virtualization, which we're not going to talk about here today, but that's an amazing new concept that basically does layer 2 isolation, taking it away from the switch and not requiring VLAN. So the multi-tenancy thing, we have a solution today, which is VLANs. We'll have a solution tomorrow, which is based on System Center. And again, you know, the whole process around, you know, how do we fix this? We talked about multiple NATing as a solution. We talked about using an RAS gateway as a solution. And some of these still we may document and they may be viable and we may publish them. So we're still working through this. But again, multi-tenancy is definitely a tough problem to solve. And here I just threw up a quote. OrcsWeb is one of the hosters we work with. They're based out of Charlotte. For them, they're extremely excited about this because, again, they do see this as a revenue-generating opportunity. So with that, let's try a demo. Let's stare at a black screen.
You're online.
Yeah. My laptop isn't. Okay. This is Metro. Who loves Metro? Come on. It's the future. Okay. So this is, I'm dual booting on my laptop here. I'm booted into Server 2012. So again, you know, nothing fancy here. So what I'm going to do is I've already created a VPN connectoid for GCI, who's our hosting partner. By the way, they're based in London. So they have offices in London and Glasgow, but right now we're going to replicate to their servers in London. So there's no need to walk you through setting up a VPN connectoid because everybody knows how to do that. So this folder here is what I got from GCI. So I emailed Rico and I said, hey, Rico, I want to do this demo at TechEd. I need a machine certificate and VPN credentials. And that's all I need. And he emails me back both. So you'll see here, I've got a, can you guys see that all right? Yeah, it's not too bad. So I have a certificate. Basically, all I have to do is double click on it. This is a machine certificate, so I'm going to check the machine store. I kind of walk through all this, and I have this super secure password that is I just typed in. And essentially now, Windows will dump the certificate into the machine store. Okay, so I've got a certificate. I'm connected via VPN. Now I just need to open up this text document, because as you see here, this is the name of the cluster that I'm actually going to replicate to. So I'm just going to cut that. So now I open up Hyper-V, and I have a virtual machine that's running here. minimize that. Okay. So there's my VM. And so for those of you that aren't familiar with Replica, I'll basically, you know, walk you through this. We don't need to see that. So you can basically go in here and you right-click. Let me see if I can. Oop, that's a little better. Okay. So I select Enable Replication. So here, I'm going to paste in the name of the server. Or in this case, I think I missed a character there. Yeah, it's HV. Sorry about that. Okay, so that's the name of the cluster. And again, it doesn't have to be a cluster. It can be an individual server. It just so happens, as I showed you in the diagram, they have clusters. So now what's happening is that the Hyper-V replica is actually going off and checking the server on the other end and determining whether or not I have permission to replicate to it. So, and by doing this, again, as I'd mentioned, there are two scenarios for replica. One is you can do intra-data center replica, which means you have to be privileged enough on both sides. Or in this case, since I'm going to a public provider, you'll see the warning that I have here at the bottom. It just says I can't get all the details because I'm not an admin on their server. So essentially, you know, they're not going to spit me back a bunch of information. So what we do is we populate the replica port. So we use 443 by default. And in here, I just go and say select certificate. And this is the certificate that I imported a second ago. I say we're going to use that. And if I hit finish here, it's going to basically start to create the local snapshot. It says, OK, you've enabled this successfully. And if I go in here and look, and I'll zoom in there for you, I've actually started sending my virtual machine over to GCI. So a bonehead like me took 2 minutes, set this up. This is site-to-site replica with a public provider. And essentially, all they had to provide me was credentials to VPN in and a machine certificate that I just double-clicked on and imported to the local store. That's how easy replica is. And more importantly, that's how easy it is to do with a public provider. So if you're a hosting provider, you have partners today, this is a very, very powerful solution. All right? You can applaud. That's a cool demo. You guys are checked out and at Universal Studios already. I get it. No problem. So, wrong one. We comp one. OK. So with that, I'm going to hand it over to my partner, Alan Stewart.
All right, good. My name is Alan Stewart. I'm the GPM of the customer engineering team. And I'm going to talk a little bit about some areas that doing the hosted cloud tap. Some areas that are really important when you start to look at architecting a solution. All right, one of those areas, the first one, which is near and dear to my heart, is storage. Right? How many of you know now that we have a ton of different storage options for you to deploy your hosted cloud or your Hyper-V solution in? Prize for anybody who can name all of them. You don't have to. All right, let's go for it. So, some of the early lessons learned from the storage perspective, our customers say, okay, should I stay on my current iSCSI or Fibre Channel environment? All right. First thing I want to say is Microsoft has a lot of options, and our recommendations are all going to be configuration-based. What that means is we're not going to take into account anything that you have in your current environment other than if you've decided to go with file-based storage, here's a configuration. If you want to stay with iSCSI or Fibre Channel-based storage, here's a configuration. If you want to make a decision on which one you should go with, you let us know which one is cost effective and most effective for you in your environment. You may see a few things that pop up around ROI, but if you've already purchased a large Fibre Channel environment, ROI may apply or it may not apply. It may just be along with what direction you decide to take in your storage environment as you move forward. So when do I use file-based storage with Hyper-V? When is it appropriate? We like to say it's appropriate for any configuration. Not just for what you might consider a low-performing configuration or what a lot of customers in the early adopter program started to use it for is for VDI scenarios. Because VDI has a sketchy, if at all proven, ROI methodology, and using high-end storage with VDI, those two things generally don't mesh very well together. So you look for other options, whether it be NAS or file-based. So a lot of customers decided, yeah, definitely for VDI I want to use file-based because it's cheap and commodity, but when I want to build out my big hosted cloud or private cloud environment, maybe I want to consider higher-end storage. And our goal is not for you to make that decision based on higher-end storage provides you more performance, just on this is your standard direction. And I'll show you some performance numbers that we have from running file-based storage, which is generally the contention point. is file-based storage as performant as fiber or iSCSI, okay? And the other thing that you need to be aware of is, what is this SMB Direct thing? And SMB over RDMA. Heck, what is even RDMA? Right? I spent a number of years working on Wall Street where RDMA technologies and InfiniBand are just pretty regular stuff that you use. But if you look at it now, we're actually taking some of this technology, which was built for high-end configurations or maybe trading applications, and just making it something that's in the just base platform. Then now you need to kind of think about when you start to look at deploying file-based storage solutions as an option. It gives you a lot of benefits. And I'm actually going to show a slide. But it also requires that you understand how to deploy it and you understand something about it. How many in here today know a lot about RDMA? Good. Actually, this is exactly what we would determine would happen when we were actually designing Windows Server 2012. We said, hey, RDMA is a great technology. We should use it. And a general manager of the storage team, Thomas Fenning, says, Alan, how many IT pros do you think know anything about RDMA? I said, probably less than 1%, right? Because it's not something you use every day. If you're in trading environments, maybe you do. So now we have this option that you need to think about when you're deploying storage, because it is the most performant file-based option. And scale out. There's a scale out file server and clustering. How many people know about that? How many people could say definitively they know when to use it for a hosted cloud or a private cloud solution? Good. So we're going to talk a little bit about that as well. When do you use a scale-out file server? What's this SMB transparent failover? And what's SMB multi-channel?
Wow.
Wow. Okay. So we'll speed up. No. When do I use a scale-out file server, and what's the benefits? Because now when you start to think about file-based solutions, you got a whole new architecture paradigm. And trust me, if some of the early engineering customers were confused, right? We have better documentation, but the choices of when to make them, we still haven't kind of laid that out, okay? All right, so in Windows Server 2012, we made a decision to say that file-based storage is a first-class citizen in the operating platform. Meaning, if you want to run workloads like SQL or Hyper-V over file-based storage, we were going to build technologies in to make that possible for you to do it. And not just run it in a performant manner. So if you went down to the booth, you saw in the keynote Hyper-V storage, Hyper-V live migration without shared storage. Everybody saw that? That's pretty cool. Yes? Right? That's the benefit of being able to run Hyper-V over SMB. But you can also run SQL Server over SMB. And let's make it even more confusing for you right now. Let's just say you're running SQL Server 2012 as virtual machines on your private cloud environment. SQL Server 2012 now can address file-based storage. In the past, if you wanted to actually make two VMs clusterable, you only had one option, and that was using iSCSI as a shared storage mechanism. Everybody with me on that one? You only had one option, and that was very painful. People didn't like that option. So in 2012, now we give you three options. You can still use iSCSI, or now you can go to virtual fiber channel. So if you decided to settle on fiber channel, the virtual machines have virtual HPAs, and they'll allow you to connect directly to the fabric. But now you have another option. SQL 2012 runs over SMB. So if you're running two virtual machines that you want to cluster, now you could use SMB as the clustering mechanism as well, specifically with SQL 2012. And if a question to ask about Exchange, don't ask me questions about Exchange in Windows Server 2012 just yet. Lots to be decided in that area, right? But now you have additional options that you can actually use in the environment. So Hyper-V over SMB and SMB applications over SMB is first-class storage. First-class storage, very performant, but now you need to start thinking about it from a design perspective. So I'm building out my private cloud. Am I going to have one server fronting 10 Hyper-V servers? Probably not. Now I start to think about ratios. I have 20 Hyper-V servers. I want to use file-based storage. How many file servers do I need? And do I need to cluster them to protect them? Which is obvious. Can't just have one. You need failover. So that's when things like SMB scale out comes into play. All right, good. So I'm going to use file-based storage. I have multiple Hyper-V servers. Now I want to build a resilient storage environment based off of file-based storage. That's when that mechanism of the SMB scale-out server comes into play. Now you're going to cluster file servers, and we call that a scale-out file cluster. And there's an actual role in Windows Server 2012 with clustering when you go about doing this. And you can still run CSV over it, cluster shared volumes, which is the great technology that we integrated in R2, but you can also protect the backend. And you can have multiple shares running off this. You can have 20, 30 Hyper-V servers going against a cluster, whether it be 2-node, 4-node, and that's all decided on how many virtual machines you're going to be running and the protection that you actually need. This configuration gives you transparent failover. How many people saw the transparent failover demo with SMB? Right, so you had a workload running inside the virtual machine. You had a connection that went away, and because the SMB3 protocol had the notion of being able to transparently move where you were connecting to from one host to another share without the application actually knowing it, that benefits you when you start to decide on how you lay out your storage for your hosted cloud environment. You gain the benefit of that when you decide to cluster your file servers. You automatically get that capability when you actually use file-based storage in the hosted cloud environment. So it's a ton of other benefits here. So now think about it. We haven't touched on all of the different scenarios, but we've probably touched on probably 6 to 10 different technologies that you have to think about when you're deciding what storage environment you use for your hosted cloud. And last but not least, you're not going to be able to talk to anybody at Microsoft who's a hosted cloud architect or spent time on the hosted cloud architecture team without talking about SMB Direct. Why? The first thing that you think about when you think about running virtual machines over file-based storage is, how in the heck am I going to recommend this to my storage director or the head of storage engineering or storage architect? Because you're anticipating the first thing they'll say. We run Fiber Channel. Running over file-based access, there's no possible way you'll be able to get the performance of Fiber Channel or the performance of a dedicated iSCSI network. What are you thinking about? This stuff can't possibly perform. So in lieu of running over a 10-gig Ethernet network or a 1-gig Ethernet network, now we have an option, what we call SMB Direct, running over RDMA. And even there, there's a few different options you need to think about. You can run InfiniBand. How many people have heard of InfiniBand? Yep, pretty common, older. You can run over InfiniBand. InfiniBand requires you to have dedicated network adapters and a dedicated InfiniBand switch. A little bit more pricey. But there's new technologies around what we call Rocky, and that's RDMA over Ethernet. So you can run RDMA over your present Ethernet-based network. So then you don't have to incur the cost of putting switches in the environment, InfiniBand switches. You just incur the cost of buying RDMA-capable network adapters. Once you buy an RDMA-capable network adapter, you're able to run RDMA. And there's another technology called iWarp, which is essentially just running over Ethernet. Right? So you think about these options now. You have to think about these options. But the benefit of RDMA is, one, lower CPU overhead on the actual file servers, and also a bigger pipe. RDMA was designed for low latency and latency-sensitive applications. So if you're running file-based storage with Hyper-V or file-based storage with SQL Server, you're running a latency-sensitive operation. Okay? And you gain some additional benefits around SMB multi-channel and SMB failover that's just inherent in SMB, because SMB is running over your RDMA stack. Okay. Now, the big question is, can I really run my Hyper-V or hosted cloud environment over a file server, over the network? So based on some preliminary results that we got running RC, you can see here, local means a direct attached disk, a disk running inside of the server. And RDMA and InfiniBand is a remote file share. This is a remote file share or a VM running over the network on a file share. Look at the local performance and the number of IOPS, and look at the benefits of running over RDMA. There's anywhere from a 5 to 10% difference with running over a remote file share. So we're within 5% of performance of running a local attached disk in a server on a remote file share. Is that within the realm of being able to run Hyper-V workloads over file-based access? Definitely is. Once you're in that 5 to 10% range of a remote file share as attached to a direct attached disk, you got a good performance solution, all right? And as you scale up the workloads, the question always becomes, oh, well, what if you scale up the workloads and you change it and you have to push a lot of I/O through the system? You still see the same benefits. And I think you mentioned that some of the numbers we showed was like shipping a DVD per second over RDMA. Some of the latest numbers, you can ship up to 4 DVDs per second over RDMA. Now, why is this important? Because you're going to have to make some cases with somebody in your company that may be the storage guys. And we saw that in the TAP program as well, where you leave and you say, well, this is great. And you go back to your company and you find out, like, well, maybe it's not so great. Or they ask you questions that you can't answer. This is to arm you with data you need to be able to make this case. And we had to arm a lot of TAP customers. We had to engage with a lot of storage folks to say, yeah, this is viable. Why don't you test it? Don't trust us. Okay, so let's move on to networking. So networking, previous versions of Hyper-V, myself along with a lot of the other engineering team members were involved in scaring you half to death around ensuring that you isolate traffic. And it got to a point where if somebody said, hey, my Hyper-V cluster is slow, I just close my eyes and say, tell me your network layout. And I'd listen for 5 adapters. If I didn't hear it, I'd say, yeah, it's your problem. You didn't isolate your traffic. You should isolate all this traffic. You isolate your live migration traffic, your CSV traffic, your host traffic, the virtual machine traffic. And if you're running network-based storage, you need a network adapter for that as well. So you're needed anywhere from 4 to 6 network adapters to have a base, good Hyper-V configuration. If I heard that, then I said, maybe it's something else. Right? Now, moving forward, the world changed a little bit. So when we were doing design for the hosted cloud scenario for Windows Server 2012, the target for OEMs was that they would ship 2 network adapters and a server. 2 10 gig network adapters. That was it. That's what they were shipping. They were moving to 10 gig Ethernet. So we had to react to that. Right? So you can run with Windows Server 2012 without isolating and adding additional network adapters in the system, you can run all those traffic profiles over just 2 network adapters, 2 teamed 10 gig Ethernet adapters. But, and let's go through this diagram. This is some of the customer zero diagrams. Let's go through it. So if you notice, if you look at the diagram that shows LBFO, RSS, and has a vSwitch with Quaz, Aves, and your ACLs, you notice on that configuration there's only 2 10 gig network adapters. 2 10 gig network adapters assumes one important fact, that you're running a 10 gig network. If you are not running a 10 gig network, the middle configuration is the configuration that you should use. And if you look at the middle, how many network adapters does it have in the middle? Right, we're back to the scaring you to death again, right? Because now you need to isolate traffic because you do not have enough bandwidth to be able to push all of the services, live migration, CSV, storage migration, host traffic, and virtual machine traffic over a 10 gig Ethernet set. And Pat talked a little bit about quality of service and some of those technologies. Those things come into play when you're running 10 gig Ethernet, because we need to do quality of service to guarantee each one of the traffic profiles for things like CSV and live migration and the virtual machines, they get enough bandwidth. So we use Quaz in that network set to guarantee each one of the services gets enough bandwidth. If you're not running 10 gig Ethernet on your network, you still need to isolate the traffic. If you notice, in that aspect, 10 gig Quaz doesn't show up. Quaz is a non-factor because you're guaranteed quality of service by guaranteeing traffic gets routed to one network adapter. You're isolating it that way. LBFO still comes into play, where you can still do load balancing and failover, but you still need to isolate the traffic. Okay? And the last configuration is around RDMA. RDMA requires 10 gig Ethernet adapters. Doesn't mean you need to be running on a 10 gig network, but the adapters themselves have RSS and RIO embedded in them. Okay? And in that configuration, again, you're back to, if you're going to run over RDMA, an RDMA network, InfiniBand, InfiniBand has enough bandwidth. Rocky, an RDMA, has enough bandwidth. In that aspect, we can put all the services and collapse them all again across a 10 gig Ethernet set and then use quality of service to guarantee bandwidth. All right, this is an important thing for you to consider and think about as you start to lay out your servers, because you may see a presentation from Microsoft that shows two 10 gig Ethernet adapters and that's it. And you may make an assumption that, wow, I don't need to isolate traffic anymore. You'd be right and you'd be wrong, right? You'd be right to say if you're running a 10 gig network, you don't need to do it anymore. If you're running 10 gig network adapters but a 1 gig network, then you need to isolate traffic. Okay? And trust me, one thing we found out is we did a really good job of scaring people into making sure they isolate traffic. So much so that Pat talked about the 50 production customers that we have running right now, the hosted cloud configuration. Initially, when they started to architect their solution, even the ones with 10 gig Ethernet had dedicated isolated NICs. And I said, well, why are you doing that? They're like, what do you mean? You told me 4 years ago I need to isolate traffic. I was like, well, it's a new day. If you're running 10 gig Ethernet, you can run it all together and use QoS. And even then they didn't believe it. Some of them still have isolated network adapters. Right? It's Pat's job to convince them moving forward. All right, so what were some of the other things that we learned? So one of the things that we learned in the file-based storage world, in order for you to run file-based storage, we require Active Directory. In order to run clusters, we require Active Directory. This was challenging for some scenarios. Think of a customer where you're running a hosted cloud environment in a DMZ. And you could argue whether AD in the DMZ works, doesn't work. If you're a security person, you can argue with yourself around whether it works or doesn't work. You don't necessarily want an AD in the DMZ, right? Everybody, it's a feeling. I don't want it in DMZ. So guess what? You want to put a cluster there? There's got to be an Active Directory host. If you wanted to use just file-based storage, let's just say you had individual Hyper-V hosts and you wanted to point them at an SMB share, which is a scenario that's not too far-fetched. Guess what that brings with it? Active Directory, right? The technology we know and love and sometimes have a hard time with. So customers wanted some flexibility to be able to deploy in work group, in a work group mode, right? And so that's something that we're actually still kind of thinking through. If you run a cluster, it's a no-brainer. You have to have Active Directory. If you just have standalone Hyper-V host that you want to use file-based storage with, that's a scenario that we're exploring to see if there's something that we can do to enable it. All right? The other thing is granular controls, storage, networking. I talked a little bit about networking and quality of service. Quality of service is something you should really start to get to know and use, particularly in Windows Server 2012. It was a technology that was always in R2, but nobody really used it. Now it is the core technology that allows you to guarantee services bandwidth in the virtual machine and at the host as well. And one thing that we found from working with hosters like quality of service because they want to eventually move to usage-based chargeback, not just charging for the VM. If you burst, use too much resources from a networking or storage perspective, they want some mechanism to be able to charge for that or to throttle that, right? And of course, in setup and management, so one thing I'll tell you, how many people know that Server Core is the default UI for Windows Server? Good. So all your feedback about Server on Metro, don't bother. Don't bother. I have an easy fix for you. Server Core. We'll talk about that one. All right, that's a good question. The question was, do we run full Server Core or do we run what we call min shell? All right? So I always try to get you to full Server Core. Run full Server Core. But if you have any sort of applications that has a GDI dependency or has a dependency on running MMC or some level of GDI or UI, you can go to MinShell. What MinShell allows you to do, it looks like Server Core, but it allows you to run GUI-based tools on top of it. So you get the best of both worlds, sort of, for those applications that are not enlightened enough to have moved forward to Server Core. Okay? And Server Core allows you to do some rich customization of the UI. The command prompt can be sped up or slowed down depending on your individual needs. That's it for customization. So I guess you didn't get that joke, right? It's just a prompt. You can do whatever you want with it. And there's a ton of PowerShell in the box now. You basically have to tell us where we didn't have coverage from PowerShell perspective. We have about 95% coverage from an automation perspective with PowerShell. And that brings along another skill for you to learn. Right? And one thing, the early adopter customers, most of them feel very comfortable deploying Hyper-V servers in Server Core. Some of them pushed back a little bit. I'm not ready for it. That's why we also have the mechanism for you to be able to switch at any time. How many people know you can switch at any time between a full and server? You can switch, get it started, configure it the way you want, say goodbye to the UI, and then move forward. Where they did have a harder time was using Server Core for non-Hyper-V servers. That's become pretty challenging for people because you don't readily know what the applications that run on those servers need from a UX perspective. And that was one of the reasons why we actually created MinShell in the first place. If you don't know, run MinShell because you can run the UI if you need it. The other thing that I kind of think Pat kind of touched on, VMM is critical. We actually take dependencies on VMM for network virtualization, but when we start early engineering validation, there is no VMM. There's a benefit to that for us in engineering perspective. It forces us to deploy the scenario with all that cool PowerShell stuff we create. So guess what? If we can't deploy it with PowerShell, you can't deploy it with PowerShell. And you would think, like, well, you kind of thought through it. It forced us to do the deployments with PowerShell. And while we were doing the deployments with PowerShell and the customer zero work, we said, you know what? We got a lot of cool PowerShell samples here that people might want to use and leverage. So out of that was the work that we published on Script Center. But we actually did end-to-end deployment of the hosted cloud scenario, including all the technologies that Pat kind of went through, including network virtualization, just using the underlying PowerShell. And trust me, we found a lot of things that weren't automatable or PowerShell that we had to add in. Yeah? Yeah. I knew that question was coming. That means people were testing. The question was, did we add better support in core for when you have 8 network adapters than providing you something better than the plug-and-play ID of which you couldn't translate or configure? If you could, we'd probably wind up hiring you somewhere along the line. All right, so it's not just a core problem or a PowerShell problem. It's a plug-and-play ID problem. We did do some stuff in LBFO for that. I don't think we went the full method that you want. You want to be able to name it and have that translate throughout the entire box. In LBFO, we allowed you to do some uniqueness with naming, but it's still a gap. It's still a gap there.
Well, Hyper-V without a name, you could name it in the box, but that
right. It was that end-to-end from plug-and-play ID into LBFO into Hyper-V. We did some stuff with LBFO. So if you're teaming network adapters, we give you some richer naming aspects of it. If you're not using LBFO, not so much. But it's a plug-and-play ID problem. I know you're like, I don't care. Plug-and-play, whoever, the team. But we know that, and that came up a lot from early engineering customers. As you start to span these things out, and then if you add vNix on top of it, then it gets really challenging. Right. And, of course, documentation and samples are really important. So if you've been doing a lot with Microsoft, you know documentation and samples are probably not only the last thing that comes out, it probably comes out a long time after the product ships, right? You get it, and you're like, you know, I love a sample on how to do something with this thing. And we're like, Yeah, you know, we just shipped it. Give us six months to a year. And while we're working on the next version, we'll get the samples out about the other version. Right? A lot of the customer zero work was about giving you stuff up front. So literally today, in the PowerPoint, you can go and pull down the samples for all the customer zero work today around configuration, network virtualization, LBFO, Hyper-V replica. You can pull all that stuff down today. And really, that was a first for us to have it available this early. And it was because of that customer zero work that now you can start to pull down some documentation and scripts. So you can go get it and start to use it. And they're professionally done and up to date. And it's actually available for even the RTM product documentation, right? And around the matrix is going to be really important because now as we have, I just walked through a very simple storage example around Filebase, Fiber Channel, iSCSI, and the layouts. But remember, I didn't even touch on storage spaces, ODX offload, thin provisioning, and dedupe. There's so many stuff in there from a storage and networking perspective. We are putting together a matrix to show you what works with what. Because what happened is, if we don't do that, you'll start to say, it'd be really great if I put all these different technologies together. That would give me an unbelievably complete solution. And I look at it and say, it looks really cool, except these four things don't work together. So why don't you, have to think it through, right? Like things like RDMA. RDMA and LBFO and how those things work together. Things like storage spaces and clustering. When do you use that? And the fact that storage spaces, most people thought, hey, I'll use storage spaces with iSCSI and Fiber Channel. Nope. Storage spaces, the only interconnects to support are USB and SAS. So if you're going to use storage spaces, you're going to use file-based storage and SAS. And that was a little bit of enlightenment for people doing storage as well. Okay. So some of these things we're addressing. Pat talked about the DCR on Hyper-V Replica. He didn't really do the scenario justice from my perspective. Why? Because this scenario did not work in the beginning. It looks simple here, but it did not work at all. We had this thing called certificate-based authentication and established trust via certificates, but it wasn't until Pat actually started working with hosters and they actually went to try it, it was like, wow. This is the only way for us to establish trust is via certificates because we can't depend on Active Directory. But those DCRs that Pat mentioned in there is because the scenario didn't work initially. Until that work and those things were changed around wildcards, the protocols that were supported from each one hosting provider as well. So some of these things are DCRs that went in to the product as well. So that should encourage you as we move forward to the next release to get involved in some of these early engineering programs because you're really helping us shape the release. All right, setup and management. One thing you want to know in hosted cloud, VMM fixes every problem. Sort of true. It fixes a lot of issues, right? The automation around Hyper-V replica, right? The ability to add some management constructs on top of it and provide you some automation and some logic around when you want to do stuff. So VMM fixes a lot of issues. It does add a lot of value, fixes a lot of issues. But we needed to actually go through the scenario without VMM. Because believe it or not, some people don't use VMM. I know it's shocking, right? Some hosters, they build their own solutions, or enterprises have other solutions they want to be able to use, too. So it's important for us to go through it as well. Parity in PowerShell. The ability for us to have coverage, but parity between min shell and regular server core is important as well. All right. NIC teaming, by far, will be the most deployed solution in Windows Server 2012. Why? Every server you deploy, you'll deploy NIC teaming. Trust me, you will. Everybody, we have 204 customers in an early engineering program, and all of them said, hey, I'm testing for you. I'm doing testing. I already set up LBFO. You're like, all right, we'd love for you to test other things, but this is the most important part. It's the basis of any server output. It's important for you to learn it and use it. And one thing that we discovered, we spent a lot of time talking to third-party NIC teaming vendors and saying, why does your stuff work? Why isn't it easier? Why isn't it more usable for people? This is what we're hearing from our customers. So guess who's on the front line of that now? We hear it. Why doesn't the team work? Why don't you be able to ping? When I set up the team, why don't you send a packet out and let me know that the team actually works? Or why isn't it more usable? So now we get all that feedback, right? And we're finding out that some of the usability stuff around teaming is now ours to own that was third parties to own before. And a lot of the samples that I talked about before are available for you to use. You should look at these samples and use some of these things. A good way for you to learn PowerShell, a good way for you to learn some of the interfaces that are available as you start to move forward before you start to get VMM. Because VMMs and CTP, they'll ship beta and then you'll be able to have a VMM instance managed Windows Server 2012. But you can actually look through some of the PowerShell that was born out of some of the scars that me and Pat actually went through. And last but not least, we're publishing all this different learning. One of the things that we want to do moving forward is we're going to be at all of these conferences moving forward. And there's so much stuff that we learn before it actually gets out. So you go here and you learn a lot about the feature. And they tell you a lot about the feature. We've been deploying those features for probably the last 18 to 24 months. So there's a lot of stuff that you can start to get out of how do you deploy these things and how do you use these things before you actually go back and start to do it. So you can avoid some headaches as you move forward, and you can get some documentation and samples. And one of the goals of the team is that beta, when you get a beta build, that you have rich samples and rich documentation that allows you to do something meaningful without poking around and discovering stuff on your own. And last but not least for us is shipping, RTMing, right? How many people here are going to deploy Windows Server 2012 as soon as it RTMs? That's good. How many people here are going to deploy Windows Server 2012 as soon as it RTMs on every single server in your enterprise? See, that's now look, all the hands are down, at least on Hyper-V host, right? Good. All right. So with that said, there's a few other sessions. There's actually one more session, actually, because we're at the end. That's it. There's one more session today around building hosted cloud, and you can go learn a little bit more about how some of those customer zero configurations. And you can actually see some of the demos are walking through some of the PowerShell scripts as well. And all right, we're good. We're pretty much done. Next. And we have 8 minutes for questions. So if you have any questions, please open up.
Or come on up if you're shy. Yes, sir.
So every single Hyper-V over SMB number that you guys throw out is over 54 gig FDR. How do they look on real networking worlds? Like, I'll give you 10 gig, right? Let's talk 10 gig. At least people run 10 gig.
Yeah.
So is it a fifth of that number, or is it still good because of multi-channeling? Or
it's still good because of multi-channeling, but it's about 20 to 25% of a locally attached disk.
Okay.
And that's a good question. You know, whenever we show the numbers, we show you nice SMB Direct, and you're like, wow. These guys are like within 3% of a real disk running in a server. When you run over just a base network, you got all the additional overhead, you're not running a low latency protocol like RDMA, it's between 20 to 25% of a locally attached disk.
Well, we can run RDMA over 10 gig NICs as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's FiniBand flow.
You have to.
Right, I mean, FiniBand's a completely different network.
Well, if you're running Rocky, and not just running InfiniBand, you're still within the 5 to 10% range of a locally attached disk. It's when you're running, when I interpret your conversation, real networking is like, all right, stop this RDMA stuff. And what about the other stuff here?
Yeah. I just mean a fabric that, I mean, raise your hand if you're running MDR, right? Raise your hand if you're running 10 gigs somewhere in your environment.
Right.
Well, I mean, the FDR example, big numbers were sexy.
Right.
And your question is very fair and very relevant.
Yeah,
but as Alan pointed out, you're still in that 20 to 25% range. So when you start to factor in, because the big thing, now you start to ask, well, okay, what about cost? You look at IB versus Rocky. Rocky is just over converged Ethernet, so there's no infrastructure cost associated with that. The IB numbers are great and sexy, but you got to have dedicated cards, dedicated switching, and that's a good chunk of money.
Yeah, yeah. And we didn't want, one thing that we don't want to do is this Hyper-V over SMB could easily get lost in storage conversations with storage directors and storage architects. So if I showed you some number that went into public slide that said it was 20 to 30% performance, if I'm a storage director, I was like, see, can't use it. With fiber channel and my expensive SAN, I'm already way better than that.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's a $10,000 solution versus a
$100,000
solution.
Exactly.
Right.
What about, you don't mention storage spaces a whole lot, but
yep.
Not over, I mean, you did scale out with centralized SAN, but what about scale out with
Yeah, we did have people. The question is, did we have people in TAP use storage spaces? We had plenty of people in TAP using storage spaces. The initial problem was being able to find some of the SaaS configurations, one. Because one thing that doesn't come out in any of these conferences is the fact that we had to work with vendors like LSI to create shared SaaS controllers. Those didn't exist. So if you're going to run a clustered space with shared SaaS, those controllers need to be able to share and be able to be clusterable. So a lot of the storage spaces work with early hardware was on the early edge of being tested. A lot of people, few people deploy very small configurations in production. If you look at Dell around some of the MD stuff, you had to find a good SaaS line, and then you had to have the right controllers. Then they had to have the right firmware. So it was a little bit testy around getting some of the hardware.
The spaces, the software was way ahead of the hardware in this case.
Yeah.
Yeah, because we still can't run spaces with everybody having a dedicated storage device. And
You're still doing SaaS. Actually, the two only interconnects that only support it with storage spaces today are SaaS and USB. And I know when I was doing it last week, we did a storage engineering forum in New York with only storage directors and architects. And we're like, storage spaces. And they're like, great. So I'm going to run this with my fiber channel and iSCSI. No. So what interconnects do you support? Well, we support SaaS and USB. And it was like, USB, right. Pretty enterprise-wide effective. I don't know about you, but I run it USB in my data center all the time. But yeah, you're going to see more information outside of RC with storage spaces now that the hardware's caught up. And at this conference, you probably heard of things about cluster in a box. Have you heard of that configuration? That uses spaces, but it uses those shared SaaS controllers. Yeah, a 2U box, two systems in it, 24 drives, all in the background shared SaaS controllers with storage spaces. Yep.
So we're not allowed to name names.
Just yet.
In fact, we took names out of this deck just because, you know, there's legal implications, and Microsoft is run by lawyers, you know, anyway. So some of them are participating in a program called Go Live. I wish I could share the names with you, but they're actually advertising on their website. If you did some searches around, like, Server 2012 Go Live, some of these providers will pop up. And again, they're literally spread out around the world. About half of them are domestic.
Yeah, if you wanted to, you know.
And there are some big names in there. Yeah. So some of the big ones you know and love are certainly in the program.
And they're offering you trial versions right now because they can't charge you for Windows Server 2012. If you wanted to do this replication, they offer you trials to be able to do this from your enterprise today.
Yeah, it's a pretty slick deal, yeah. Anything else?
So, up on this gentleman's question around the networking. So, what happens if you have an even slower network, but, you know, really with virtualization, often the issue is not throughput, it's I/O rate. And I'm wondering if even a slow network is actually okay because you're more constrained by your I/O rate than throughput.
Let's just take the slowest possible option is just a 1 gig shared network, right? On a 1 gig shared network, you can absolutely run virtual machines with Hyper-V over a 1 gig network. The problem starts to happen is you incur higher CPU rates on the file servers because the file servers are doing extra work. There's nothing to offload some of the file serving and I/O bandwidth. On RDMA and on 10 gig Ethernet, you have things like RSS. You have offloading capability. So you don't incur the cost on the file server or on the Hyper-V server because the Hyper-V server in that instance is an SMB client. So if you're incurring the cost of CPU on the Hyper-V server, you're running less virtual machines. And if you're incurring it on a file server, you're running less connections. It will absolutely work. You just have to think about how you scale it out. You know, and offer multiple connections. SMB multi-channel will help you, but you only have so much bandwidth to use. You eventually run out of overhead. But we do have customers initially that were deploying those types of configurations. But when you start to think about, I want to use file-based storage as the back end for my private cloud, you really have to take into account looking at some of the 10 gig Ethernet, or even some of the RDMA technologies as well. So, any more questions?
Okay.
Great. Thanks for your time.
Folks. We'll see you at the party.